From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Earlier this year, actor Matthew Broderick became singer Matthew Broderick. He debuted in his first Broadway musical, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Broderick won a Tony Award for his performance. Next month, he's leaving the show. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with him from last May. Also, writer Paul Auster talks about his movies Smoke and Blue in the Face. Milo Miles reviews a tribute album to Harry Nilsson. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Leaving Las Vegas, starring Nicolas Cage. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The gunman who attacked a large group of soldiers at Fort Bragg this morning is also a soldier. Army officials at the North Carolina base say the man belongs to the 82nd Airborne, which is stationed at Fort Bragg. All but one of the 18 soldiers wounded in the pre-dawn attack were members of the same elite division. One soldier was killed in the shooting. The motive for today's incident isn't yet known. An Army spokesman says he has no other information about the suspect and it is not known when charges will be filed. President Clinton says today's report on the gross domestic product shows that his economic plan for the country is working. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
In a brief question and answer session with reporters, Mr. Clinton pointed to the surge in third quarter economic growth and said there's a strong message in there for Republican budget cutters. The message, he's right and they're wrong.
This program, now we have 3 years of evidence, is not only morally right, it is working for the country, and we need to keep going in this direction.
The Commerce Department said the economy grew at an annual rate of 4.2% in the third quarter, the strongest since the end of last year. And it also said that a part of the report that measures inflation showed the lowest increase in 32 years. Bill Small at the White House.
Senators are sorting through amendments to the balanced budget plan. They've rejected a Democratic alternative. It would have balanced the budget without providing a tax cut, as Republicans wish to do. In another vote, the Senate restored federal nursing home standards that otherwise would have been dropped from the bill. The Republican plan in the Senate would balance the budget within 7 years. It would cut Americans' taxes by $245 billion and restructure Medicare, Medicaid, and many other social programs. It's expected the bill will pass. President Clinton has threatened a veto. The United Nations is hosting a conference today on Liberia. That country has been ravaged by 6 years of civil war. The conference's purpose is to find Liberia's economic needs and ways to strengthen the new but shaky peace. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Since the outbreak of civil war in 1989, over 150,000 people have been killed in Liberia. Nearly three-quarters of the country's population has been forced to flee their homes. As well, the country's economic infrastructure has been virtually destroyed, and agricultural production is less than 10% of pre-war levels. The question facing the international community is how to rebuild the country following the establishment of a shaky peace last August when the warring factions agreed to form a council of state. Currently, there are just over 7,000 international peacekeepers in Liberia, but it's estimated about 5,000 more are needed to help disarm the combatants and monitor the ceasefire. UN officials say this will cost about $100 million, on top of the millions needed to pay for humanitarian relief. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 27 points. This is NPR. Tropical Storm Tanya has formed in the Caribbean, the 19th named storm of the season. The National Hurricane Center says Tanya is less than 600 miles southeast of Bermuda, but forecasters say the storm currently poses no threat to land. 1995 has been a busy hurricane season. Only 1993, or rather 1933, was a busier one, with 21 named storms. There are just two names left to be used on the 1995 storm season, Van and Wendy. If there are more storms than that, forecasters plan to go to the Greek alphabet for new names. The religious leader of the Islamic group Hamas is calling on members to stop attacks on Israel. Sheikh Amin Yassin also says Hamas members should also run in upcoming Palestinian elections. He made the appeal in a jail cell interview. If Hamas members comply with his wishes, a major obstacle to increased peace in Israel would be lifted. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Matthew Broderick is preparing to leave
the House of Representatives. Marcos won an overwhelming majority, John Miller reports.
With a crowd of supporters cheering her on, Imelda Marcos swore to uphold the country's constitution as a duly elected member of Congress. The Supreme Court declared her eligible on Wednesday, despite questions about her residency and a corruption conviction 2 years ago. She still faces more than 100 civil and criminal charges. She has appealed a 1993 verdict that carried a minimum 18-year prison term. Imelda Marcos was elected to represent the Central Philippine District where she spent her childhood. It's the heart of what is by now a very narrow political support base. She finished fifth in presidential elections in 1992, and her son, Ferdinand Jr., failed to win a Senate seat last May. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Manila.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Matthew Broderick is preparing to leave his starring role in the Broadway revival of Frank Lesser's musical, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. At the end of November, he'll be replaced by John Stamos of Full House and General Hospital fame. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Broderick recorded last spring, shortly after the opening of How to Succeed. It's his first Broadway musical, and he won a Tony Award for his performance. Broderick starred in Broadway productions of Neil Simon's Brighton Beach Memoirs and Biloxi Blues, and he starred in the films War Games, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, The Freshman, Glory, and The Road to Wellville. How to Succeed is a musical comedy from 1961 about ambition, office politics, and relations between the sexes. It's set in the worldwide Widget Corporation, where J. Pierpont Finch, a window washer, reads a self-help manual called How to Succeed in Business, which teaches him how to fake his way to the top. From the revival's cast recording, here's Broderick as Finch, singing the best-known song from the show, I Believe in You. Finch is singing the song to himself, brimming with confidence as he gazes approvingly at his reflection in the mirror.
You have the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Yet there's that upturned chin and the grin of impetuous youth.
You know what I really appreciated the night I saw How to Succeed? There's something very cynical about, you know, the story of How to Succeed. But what really shines through everything, I thought, was your affection, and I'd have to say all of the performers' affection for the material. There was just this kind of, like, love for the material, for the whole Broadway style, I thought, that seemed to go into the show.
That was
just a real pleasure.
Yeah, well, we do really love it. I mean, the more you work on it, it's a just really beautifully constructed thing. I love all the songs and all the dialogue that Abe Burrows wrote. It's just very funny, and it remains funny.
Is there a different energy that you feel in a musical than you feel in a drama or a comedy? You've done dramas and comedies on Broadway before.
Well, there is a little bit. Somebody once said that, you know, the book scenes, which are, you know, the scenes that aren't songs in a musical, are really, can be thought of as part of the music also. So that there's meant to be kind of there's more of a rhythm to things. You know, whereas in a straight play or a comedy, you can sort of take your own timing. A musical seems to all, you know, people get more and more excited until they're so frantic that the only way they can express it is to sing.
So
you have to, everything has to build up to so that these songs don't come out of nowhere. So it's a little bit more of a rigid form in a way. It's, you know, some of the Neil Simon comedies I've done are a little bit more, you can let them drift in different directions, which is fun. But they don't always have these bookmarks that you have to get to, you know, these songs.
I know that during part of the time that you've been doing How to Succeed, you've also been finishing a film that you directed with a screenplay by your mother. It's called Infinity, and it's about the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman.
Right.
And I believe it about his relationship with his wife, who had tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me you have had to go back and forth from one mood to another, from one worldview, the musical comedy worldview, to a more serious,
yeah,
perhaps tragic point of view.
Yeah, yeah, it's very strange. That movie shot literally up until the day before the first rehearsal of How to Succeed. I finished shooting and drove down to La Jolla and started rehearsal the next day. And then rehearsed and then opened in La Jolla for 5 weeks and then started editing. I was very concerned, I remember, because I was sort of trying to keep my eye on the, you know, I had to do some editing even when I was, you know, sort of by the phone when I was doing the play. And I would wake up thinking about the movie or having had some dream or some idea for the movie, and I thought, this is really bad because I have to wake up thinking about the play now, you know. For some reason with me, a lot of ideas seem to come to me, like, as I wake up. So I was very worried, so I had to sort of figure out a way to forget the movie,
mm-hmm.
because you need that time when you're not consciously thinking about something, but that it's what's on your mind. And I don't seem to be able to do that with two things.
No, I know that you worked with your father, the late James Broderick. I think your first professional role was in a play with him?
Yeah, it was not a paying role, but it was, yeah. I did a Horton Foot play with him when I was 17 and at the HB Studio here in New York.
So he played your father?
He played my father. And we were both Southern, and I was a sort of bad son, a bad seed or whatever.
What was it like to be getting your start in playing with your father on stage?
Well, it was, it wasn't all that easy for some reason.
I can imagine. I mean, people can't learn to drive often from their father.
No, yeah, and I tried that one too, I remember. My father tried to teach me to drive, and he would make me so angry and nervous that I remember once winding up on a grassy median between two roads, just in the middle of a field, with him, you know, yelling at me. So
you don't want this to happen on stage.
No. I remember the job was then given to my sister, and I learned very easily. But, yeah, there is something about... He was a great help to me when I was, you know, when I was doing plays in high school. He would be... you know, come and watch and give me great advice. But when I was actually working with him, it was not so easy. And he would, you know, a lot of the scenes were him being mad at me. And he would yell at me with this Southern accent, and it was hard to take seriously for some reason. It just felt like Dad being a ham.
So he'd yell at you in character.
Yeah, you know, in the scene, you know,
right,
brother, you're not taking care of business the way you ought to, you know, whatever. And, and I would just think, Dad, you know, you're making a fool out of yourself or whatever. It was kind of hard. And I think my total lack of experience, too. But it was a big, you know, it was a big step. But once I did that one, the next one was all the easier.
How did show business look to you watching your father when you were a kid?
Thrilling. I loved being around the theater, and I didn't even know if I wanted to be an actor. I really kind of didn't want to be an actor, but I did think I'd like to do something in the theater, you know, like run lights or paint scenes or anything, because I just liked the atmosphere, you know, for some reason. And I loved being in the dressing room and watching him, you know, put on his makeup and stuff. Well, it was a little bit like, you know, when you're a kid and you watch your father shave.
Mm-hmm.
It had that kind of romance, you know. I thought it was great.
One of your early roles was in Torch Song Trilogy, and you were in it at the start when it was off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And you played a gay teenager who's adopted by the main character, the Harvey
Firestein
character. Were you advised against playing a gay role that early in your career, that everybody would assume you were gay and you'd
right.
be typecast?
Yeah, I was a little bit. I had an agent who said, you know, I don't think this is advisable, you know, just because it's your first thing. And, you know, he incidentally, like, was probably gay, which is also an interesting thing about the world. But anyway, I was so desperate to work. You know, I'd like to say I was brave and moral and all these things, which maybe I was, but I was also just desperate to work. And I also loved the play. I thought it was really funny and a great role. So I never occurred to me to listen to him. I just thought, no, no, no. And now, I of course, I think it's, you know, it's fine. I don't think people think about that risk too much anymore.
You were discovered in that play.
Yeah, no, it worked out. It was this teeny, rotten little theater, you know, and the play was over 4 hours long. And nobody was coming. And it was going to close before its run was over. And a critic, I think Mel Gussow from The Times, happened to come and wrote this rave. And that made all the other critics come. And before he knew it, we were this kind of little hit. And then we moved to, you know, they redesigned and made beautiful this theater downtown, which was right near my house. And we all moved there. And then, of course, later it went to Broadway without me. But it just was this... It was very fortunate because when I got the job, it seemed like a kind of nothing little job. And it, once I was in it, it turned into this big deal. I might not have gotten the job if it had been known it was going to be such a thing, you know.
So did anyone assume you were gay and therefore couldn't play straight roles after seeing you in the film?
No,
I mean, in the play?
No. I mean, maybe people assumed I was gay. I don't know. But I never, you know, I got the Neil Simon job basically from that, which was a straight teenager. I mean, that never seemed to be a problem. I would get some fan mail that assumed I was gay, I remember. But I never seemed like stuck in, I never got offered only gay parts. And in fact, I don't think I got offered any other gay parts.
Did you get a lot of letters, you know, "Dear Matthew, tell us if you're straight or gay"?
I just remember one that was from a man who said, oh, no, it was from who I had met backstage, and his son wrote me this long and crazy letter, which was, he didn't speak English that well, so I can't describe how strange it was, but I remember it said at some point, "Matt, I am gay and my father is too. Are you as well? If not, perhaps you would enjoy my sister's sexy looks." And it had a picture of this boy and his sister standing in the Mediterranean up to their knees. And he just looked like this kind of chubby, rich boy. And next to him was this sort of scrawny, like Diane Arbus-like sister, you know, holding a soda or something. And I thought, wow, I wonder what her life is like with a gay father and brother, and they're offering her to the straight ones. It was a very weird...
Did you write back?
No, but I kept the letter for a long time. But I don't have it anymore.
We're listening to an interview recorded last spring with Matthew Broderick. Next month, he's leaving his starring role in the Broadway revival of How to Succeed. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Matthew Broderick. I think for years in movies, you were playing younger than you were in real life.
Right.
Like in War Games and Ferris Bueller. How old were you when you made those films?
When I made War Games, I was 20, and I was playing a 17-year-old, which is percentage is much younger. And then when I did Ferris Bueller, and I was still playing high school, you know, 18 or something, I was like, I think I was 23. Yeah, that's right.
Were you afraid you were going to get stuck in teenage films?
Yeah, I was. I was also because Ferris Bueller was this big success, and I think that there's always a desire to for people who have a similar script or whatever to think, well, we'll have a success if we use the same formula. So you get they lead to the same role coming over and over again, more or less. So I was a little bit afraid of that. And I sort of consciously tried to play older things, which I did, which was a bit of a struggle, because a lot of them would turn out not to be very successful or whatever. So it's been a bit of a struggle to let the parts age along with me.
I enjoyed you in The Freshman, where you're a film school student, and mm-hmm. you're studying The Godfather in class, and of course right. then meet Marlon Brando, mm-hmm. who's got some Godfather like stuff of his own happening on the side. Was it fun to work with Brando? Did his films mean a lot to you when you were coming of age?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I thought of him as the best actor in the world, and I still do. So I remember being sent that. I liked the script too. Andy Bergman wrote it, and I said, "Well, who's playing?" I don't remember if I. Anyway, I found out that the role was being played by Brando, and like everyone else, I was skeptical. I remember going in for a meeting with the director, writer, and a producer, and I said, "Is Brando really? Is this real? Is he really going to do this? Because I don't think he'd worked in a long time." And I remember they had a wallet filled with photographs of them with Brando, you know, in Tahiti. And they would say, "See, here we are shaking his hand. Here he is saying, you know, he really is coming." And I said, "Well, it's fantastic." So I joined right on, you know, just for the opportunity to meet him.
Is he really quirky in how he does scenes?
We rehearsed more than I would have thought. He kind of liked to rehearse a little bit, and he would work on the, he'd change some of the dialogue a little bit when he rehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember him when I would act opposite him, that he was just the most lively thing in the world. He's so interesting to watch, and he's so involved in you that you have only to, you know, pay a little bit of attention to him and you'll be fine, it seemed to me. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, I remember in soccer, you know, with the good players, would, if they pass you the ball, it goes right to where your feet are. So you end up having an easier time and looking better. And he seemed to me one of those actors that just makes your job much easier, because he's passing you such good stuff.
I think Glory must have been an important film for you. You played, you led an African-American regiment during the
right.
Civil War. And this is, I mean, it's a military film. It's a film about the war, about race in America. It's an action film as well, because there's a lot of war sequences. So
right.
a lot of different stuff for you.
Yeah. That was also a project that I was connected to for a long, long time. And for some reason, yeah, I don't remember, like 2 years or so before it even came on. And I loved the story, and I read all about that character. I read a lot of his letters, and I read a few books. And I also ended up getting very involved in the script.
Did you see Glory as an opportunity to prove that you could do something different than anything you'd done before in film?
Yeah, in a kind of objective way. But really, you know, I just thought of it. I thought it was a great story. And I thought, I didn't know anything about, you know, African-Americans in the Civil War. I don't even think I knew that they fought. And they fought a lot. This is just one story. So I thought it was very important. Everybody involved in it thought it was very important that the news get out.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very aware of that. And I was also very aware of the character I played, who was, you know, this Boston upper class guy, but how much his kind sacrificed and gave, you know, his family and everybody to the cause of ending slavery. So I also thought of him as a hero, and I thought that was an important thing to get out, you know, that there were some very brave, rich white people, you know, at that time who did make great sacrifices.
What was shooting the war scenes like for you? They're very, you know, the chaos of battle type of scenes.
Yeah, they were, they're chaotic, you know, by nature. Very few people were hurt. You know, I think some people, there were a couple of broken legs and bones every now and then, but nothing too serious.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the numbers, but I think at one point we had about 4,000, two to 4,000 extras in battle uniform with rifles, with bayonets on the end of them.
Wow.
And at night, you know, that final scene is a night charge. And there were mortars, you know, there are these explosions. So you have to, you see these little flags in the sand and you know not to run near there because that could explode. And there's also, the special effects man is watching very carefully and he knows not to set off any charge if somebody's near it. So it's that is safe in a way. But it's very, very, everybody's yelling and the adrenaline is flying, you know. And some of the time I was on a horse who would get sort of hysterical. So it was a challenge. But very, very exciting also. I mean, I guess that's why those reenactors like that, doing that. You know, there is something fun. Although I think they're great. Never mind.
Now that you're singing on Broadway, do you want to keep singing? With a song in my heart.
Yeah, sometimes I think, wow, the next time I do a play and there's no singing, I'll feel like, gee, something's missing. I don't know. It was a lot of work, but I think I would love to do more musicals, you know, provided that somebody wants me to. There are a lot of great musicals out there. I'd love to do more,
sure.
Tell you the truth.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Matthew Broderick recorded last spring. At the end of November, he's leaving his starring role in the Broadway revival of How to Succeed. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
There is a brotherhood of man, a benevolent brotherhood of man, a noble tie that binds all human hearts and minds into one brother. Giving each brother all you can. Oh, aren't you proud to be in that fraternity, that great big brotherhood of man? So, Ollie, I want you to remember that before you consider firing Mr. Bigley.
Who's considering that?
You see, Wally, I know what's on your mind. You'd like to clear out the whole crowd of them from top to bottom. That's the obvious choice.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writer Paul Auster talks about the new movie Blue in the Face, which is improvised by the stars of Auster's film Smoke after Smoke was completed. Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Leaving Las Vegas, and Milo Miles reviews a new Harry Nilsson tribute album.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the great lost styles in popular music was created in the 1960s by songwriters and performers who understood both the old pop and the new rock. These artists included Randy Newman, Jimmy Webb, and Harry Nilsson. Critic Milo Miles takes a look back at Nilsson in light of a new tribute album of his songs done by others. Milo says that while Nilsson was not exactly the true American Beatle, as has been claimed, he was as independent and alternative as any music being made today.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
Though Harry Nilsson wrote it, the song One became a top 10 hit for Three Dog Night in 1969, and I wonder if anybody under 30 remembers even that version. Nilsson keeps getting, well, misplaced in public consciousness because he doesn't fit in anywhere. Yet his work can be flat brilliant. With his uncanny dramatic timing and pure, skyrocketing voice, Nilsson turned the sensitive guy whine of Without You into an epic hurt. Of course, even a marionette like Mariah Carey can sort of duplicate Without You, but I dare to follow it up with a Nilsson song like You're Breaking My Heart. It has lyrics we still can't play and which cost him his middle-of-the-road audience when he released it on the follow-up to his biggest album, Nilsson Schmilsson. But then, you could never tell if he was going to be sweet or savage or both.
10 little Indians standing in a line. One stood looking at another man's wife. Then there were 9. 9 little Indians, their hearts all full of hate. One took another's goods. Then there were 8.
Nilsson was born in Brooklyn in 1941 and struggled as a songwriter in the early 60s. Working with Phil Spector, among others. His career was made in 1968 when the Beatles declared that Nilsson was both their favorite solo artist and group. He became chums with the Brit Wonders, particularly Ringo Starr and John Lennon. He had his early 70s hits, partied famously with Lennon in L.A., faded with the 70s, and basically spent the last 15 years of his life in semi-retirement. He died on Valentine's Day, 1993. Inexplicably, Nilsson never played concerts and only performed on TV a couple times. But it seems plain to me why he gradually stopped recording, and it's one of the most fascinating things about him.
In the wintertime, keep your feet warm, but keep your clothes on.
Nilsson was a songwriter steeped in the forms and tones of Broadway tunes, Tin Pan Alley, and the Brill Building. He didn't have much feel for blues or gospel and had a hard time stomping out rhythmically. In other words, most of his music instincts looked to the past. But his modern rock and roll mind could sense the pre-rock forms were exhausted. This is the way in which he was really like the Beatles. He adored the old music, but he had to destroy it. So time and again you get loving demolitions of sentimentality or slightly skewed tales of puppies and teardrops. Yet once he had burned down the old forms to his satisfaction, Nilsson could never come up with anything to replace them. Hence, silence. The place to begin with Nilsson is the 2-CD anthology Personal Best. It focuses too much on his pop crossover potential and not enough on his lunacy, but it's a full-length portrait. Advanced Nilsson scholars should pick up the recent tribute album For the Love of Harry. There are a number of perceptive participants like Randy Newman, Brian Wilson, Victoria Williams, and Marshall Crenshaw. Then, as is usual with tribute albums, about a third of the performances are mailed in or have nothing to say. But Nilsson's wistful, wandering soul survives in numbers like Jimmy Webb's treatment of Lifeline. Nilsson was a man out of time, but his work has aged not at all.
Milo Miles is a writer living in Cambridge. Harry Nilsson's Personal Best collection is on RCA Records. The tribute album For the Love of Harry is on the Music Masters label. From the tribute album, here's Jimmy Webb doing Lifeline.
Down.
anybody else here. It's cold, and I'm so lonely, hello. Is there anybody else here? Hello, won't you throw me down a lifeline? I'm so afraid of darkness, and down here it's just like that time.
This is Fresh Air. A couple of years ago, Wayne Wang, the director of Chan is Missing and the Joy Luck Club, read a story by my guest Paul Auster about a cigar store owner. Wang asked Auster to expand the story into a screenplay. The result was this year's movie, Smoke. After Smoke was completed, writer Paul Auster, director Wayne Wang, actor Harvey Keitel, and several other actors from the film stayed on the set to improvise a film called Blue in the Face, which opened nationally last week. I spoke with writer Paul Auster last summer and asked him first about Smoke. It centers around a cigar store in Brooklyn, owned by a character named Augie, played by Harvey Keitel. One of his regular customers is a novelist who smokes small cigars, played by William Hurt. In this clip from the film, Hurt is talking to a young man who saved his life. Hurt is telling a story about a Russian soldier and his passion for books and cigarettes.
It's 1942, right? He's caught in Leningrad during the siege. I'm talking about one of the worst moments in human history. 500,000 people died in that one place. And there's Bakhtin, holed up in an apartment, expecting to be killed any day. He has plenty of tobacco, but no paper to roll it in, so he takes the pages of a manuscript he's been working on for 10 years and tears them up to roll his cigarettes.
His only copy.
His only copy. I mean, if you think you're gonna die, what's more important, a good book or a good smoke? So he huffed and he puffed, and little by little he smoked his book.
Paul Auster told me he was more involved in the making of Smoke than screenwriters usually are in their films.
From what I'm told, and I'm really a naive in all this, an innocent, usually the screenwriter will finish his script, hand it over to the director, and then disappear. And that's the last they ever have to do with each other. Somehow or other, Wayne and I became great friends in the process. And when we finally did get the backing for the film, without even discussing it, we just went on working together. We cast the movie together, auditioned actors together, scouted locations together, and just stuck with it right to the end. And after the shooting was over, we were in the editing room together for months and months working on the film. And then we did the music together even. So as you'll see in the front of the film, it says a film by the two of us. And I think it's rather unprecedented these days for a writer and director to collaborate so closely.
After the completion of Smoke, several of the actors stuck around to do an improvised film together called Blue in the Face. How did Blue in the Face get made?
Oh, this was a crazy story. It actually happened early on, even before the filming for Smoke began, Wayne and I rehearsed with all the actors for about a month. People were coming in and working over their parts. And early on, Harvey came in with the characters that I called the OTB men, the guys who hang around the cigar store, Giancarlo Esposito and Steve Jevedon and Jose Zuniga. And the four of them were in there warming up, starting to rehearse their scenes together. And just to get to know each other in their roles, they asked if they could improvise a bit. And of course, there was no problem with that. And they started working together just off the tops of their heads. And it was so funny, so wonderfully vibrant that Wayne and I were laughing our heads off. And it's a kind of burst of enthusiasm. He said, you know, after Smoke is finished, we should make another film. Just go back into the cigar store for a few days and film the four of you and see what happens. So from that core of four people, it expanded little by little by little. And all during the production of Smoke, we were preparing for Blue in the Face. I wrote out situations for all the actors. No dialogue, or just sometimes suggested lines, but two or three pages outlining each scene. And while Wayne was working on the set of Smoke, I was running around town talking to the actors and discussing the scenes, situations, their parts, and we got started on Blue in the Face on a Monday. Smoke finished on a Friday, and by the next Monday, we were doing the other film.
There's a scene early on in Blue in the Face in which a woman's purse is snatched.
Yes,
and Harvey Keitel chases after the teenager, the child, stole the purse, brings the kid and the purse back, delivers the purse to her, and she doesn't want to press charges, and Keitel's really angry. This is one of the scenes that you came up with for the actors to improvise around?
Yes. Actually, it's a true story. It seemed like the quintessential New York story. A woman is walking down the street, and a kid, about 11 years old, snatched her purse and ran away. Down Broadway it was. A man saw this happen and chased after the kid. And after a couple of blocks, caught up with him, dragged him back to the woman, at which point a large crowd had gathered around all this commotion. And he took the purse from the boy, gave it to the woman, and said, okay, now let's call the police, have him arrested. And the woman looked at the boy, who was just a child, and melted and said, I can't press charges. He's just a baby. I can't send such a young person to jail. And the man got very angry, and he said, it's people like you who are ruining New York. You won't take responsibility. You know, who's going to teach children a lesson about right and wrong if we don't? And she said, I'm sorry, I just can't do it. And he got so angry at her that he ripped the purse out of her hands and turned around and gave it back to the boy and said, it's yours. Go on, get out of here. Take it. And the kid ran off completely confused and had the purse. So we used that scene to open the film.
Now, there are a lot of actors who do scenes in Blue in the Face. Madonna, Roseanne,
mm-hmm.
Lou Reed is there.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Jarmusch, the director, is mm-hmm. there. How did you get them all to participate?
Well, each one was for a slightly different reason. For example, Roseanne had always wanted to work with Wayne on something. And as the project started developing and we decided that we would actually bring in new people and not just confine ourselves to the cast members of Smoke, we called her, and she was delighted and came in like a real trooper and worked very hard.
There's a couple of scenes with Lou Reed, the songwriter and singer, guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't seem like an improvised performance. It seems like he's talking about his life. It seems very autobiographical.
Well, it's we did this at the end of the second day of shooting, I remember. And I should say that during that time, in those July days, Wayne got sick. So I had to take over everything. I was directing the film. And Lou is a friend of mine. And for some reason, it occurred to me that he would be very interesting in this film. we didn't know exactly what we were going to do with him, but just plunk him down behind the counter of the cigar store and ask him questions. And that's what I did. I was off camera asking him questions, and he was answering off the top of his head. It's all completely extemporaneous.
I'm scared in my own apartment. I'm, you know, I'm scared 24 hours a day, but not necessarily in New York. I actually feel pretty comfortable in New York. I get scared like in Sweden. You know, it's kind of empty. They're all drunk. Everything works. If you, you know, if you stop at a stoplight and don't turn your engine off, people come over and talk to you about it. You go to the medicine cabinet and open it up, and there'll be a little poster saying, in case of suicide, call. You turn on the TV, there's an ear operation. These things scare me. New York, no.
In the written film, In Smoke,
mm-hmm.
the Harvey Keitel character, the character who is the cigar store owner, is also a photographer, and every day for years, at a certain time in the morning, the same time every morning, he stands on the corner and takes pictures of the corner that his cigar store is on. Same shot every day,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, the cast of characters change, the lighting changes, the weather changes, and he's got, I don't know, like 4,000 of these photographs. I thought that was such an interesting concept, and I wonder what made you think of that as his hobby.
Well, I don't know where it came from. It is a strange thing to do with yourself, but at the same time, I think, how shall I put it? I think this project, this photo project, is really the very heart of the film. And what it's all about at bottom is somehow the dignity of everyday life. You know, the importance of everything that happens in the universe. You know, it's one little corner in Brooklyn, and you think, this is not anywhere, this is nowhere, this is not important. But everything is important, and if you pay attention to it, if you really look at what's in front of your nose, you know, you're living more fully. You're participating in human life and the world around you. And I think in a very almost mystical way, you know, Augie's project has great, great meaning for him and if you think about it, for anybody.
It's funny, you know the movie My Dinner with Andre with Wallace Shawn and Andre Gregory? They're having a debate in part of that film about whether you need to climb the Himalayas to find a larger meaning in life or whether you can find everything that the world means in your corner cigar store. And I guess your movie is the movie
that's right.
that makes the case for the corner cigar store, literally.
I mean, you can be, you know, Walt Whitman and go all over the world and travel all over America and write your amazing poems, or you could be Emily Dickinson and never leave your room and write your equally amazing poems. There are two approaches to the world, and both are valid.
Which is your approach?
Which is my approach? I think somewhere in between. I mean, I've moved around quite a bit, but at the same time, all my impulses are to sit in one place.
And write.
And write, or look, or think, or just dream my dreams. But so I would say I'm a rather immobile traveler.
Now, I know of at least one extraordinary thing in your family's past, which you found out about, I think, a little late in life. And if I have the story straight, your father's mother shot and killed her husband?
No.
No.
No. No. This was my, let me see, did you just say my father's mother?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Oh,
that's true.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, right. This is something I've written about, so I suppose I can talk about it. It was, yeah, a big family secret, and but somehow or other, eventually, over many, many years later, the secret came out. And so it's an important story.
How old were you?
When I heard about this?
Uh-huh.
Oh, in my 20s.
Well, that's pretty old to find out something so dramatic that completely changes the nature of your family.
Yes, yes. Definitely.
Do you know why your grandmother shot your grandfather?
No, not exactly. I mean, I could give you reasons, but I don't know why anyone does anything like that. I mean, there were external reasons. She was acquitted in her trial. But no, one can't really explain anything like that, I think.
As a writer, you know, as somebody who spends your life dreaming up stories, and, you know, sometimes pretty dramatic ones, sometimes pretty far-fetched ones, sometimes ones that are almost parables, what was it like to realize that a story of such drama was actually something real that happened in your life?
Well, it is, it's part of your education as a human being, you know, that things happen, and they can happen to you just as easily as to a stranger. And that this is how the world works. I would say that the most dramatic thing that ever happened to me, the thing that probably made me who I am today and causes me to write the way I do, is that when I was 14 years old, I was on a hike through the woods with kids from a summer camp that I went to, and there was a very big storm in the woods, and the boy standing right next to me was struck by lightning and killed. Bang, just like that. You know, one of my friends. And there it is, you know, zap, a life is taken away. And this is something that I actually witnessed. I mean, the family story is murkier, but this is something I was there to see and experience myself. And that life can end so quickly, that things can change so abruptly and without warning is, you know, an amazing lesson to learn so early.
Oh, I know. And one person will, as a result, become timid and fearful, while another person will develop this kind of, like, zest for living in the moment.
That's right. That's right. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to respond to things. But it's this kind of event that I continue to meditate upon and
mm-hmm.
try to explore and try to make sense of in one way or another.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Paul Auster wrote the screenplay for the film Smoke and collaborated on the new film Blue in the Face. His latest novel, Mr. Vertigo, is being made into a film. Our interview was recorded last summer. Coming up, a review of the new film Leaving Las Vegas. This is Fresh Air. Just 2 weeks after learning that his book, Leaving Las Vegas, was going to be made into a movie, the writer John O'Brien committed suicide. His father has said that the book itself was a suicide note, and in fact, O'Brien left no other. Now Mike Figgis, the director of Internal Affairs and Stormy Monday, has written and directed the movie on a shoestring budget. And MGM, which bought it for a reported $1 million, is releasing it slowly across the country, starting this week. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Leaving Las Vegas.
A dark, jazzy mood piece about an alcoholic drinking himself to death. Can't wait, you're saying, right? Yeah, right. It's no wonder that Mike Figgis had to make Leaving Las Vegas on the smallest budget he could, and that MGM would pay so little to distribute it. The wonder is how good this movie is. It's a tough, funny, altogether captivating tone poem about a man who has accepted self-destruction, and who eventually falls in love with the only woman willing to help him achieve it. That man is Ben, a failed screenwriter who has become a small-time Hollywood production executive, and he's now drunk himself into such a state of ineptitude that he can't even hold that job. He accepts his firing gently, even gladly. All he really wants now is the freedom to embrace his chosen fate. Ben is played by Nicolas Cage, and from the moment you see him in a liquor store, exuberantly stocking up, you know that you're in the hands of a remarkable actor giving the performance of his life. Cage makes Bennett once tortured and oddly serene, a man who knows himself and has accepted his dark path almost heroically, the way a Homeric warrior might. Ben drives to Las Vegas, checks into a cheap hotel, and begins drinking. But it's a lonely way to go, and he's soon drawn to an equally lonely prostitute named Sarah, who may or may not be able to help him. Sarah is attracted to Ben's gentleness and probably to his helplessness as well, but when she agrees to go out with him, as a woman, not as a pro, she does have a question or two.
So why are you a drunk?
Why am I drunk? Why, is that really what you want to ask me?
Yes.
Well, then this is our first date. Or our last. Until now, I wasn't sure it was either.
First. It's our first. I just want to know. Why are you killing yourself?
Interesting choice of words. I don't remember. I just know that I want to.
Are you saying that your drinking is a way to kill yourself?
Or killing myself is a way to drink.
Very clever.
Sarah is played by Elizabeth Shue, who until now has been best known for being chirpy and benign in movies like Adventures in Babysitting. To say that this is the finest performance of her career is to underestimate it. Sarah is that movie cliche, the whore with a heart of gold. But without ever quite losing her chirpiness, Elizabeth Shue brings deeply sorrowful shades to the role. She's a tough girl who's never really been as tough as she lets on. The only simulacrum of love she's known has been at the hands of a vicious, paranoid pimp, played by Julian Sands. So for her, someone who just wants her to help him die, however hideously, is a big step up, big enough to devote her life to. Figgis has put together a gorgeous score of mournful jazz standards, and he uses Las Vegas magnificently. The nights streaked with neon are like a reflection of the movie's tone, inky blackness with flashes of cool light. Yet Leaving Las Vegas isn't a sour film, or a depressing one either. Ben's way of dying can't be condoned, but his acceptance of his own tragedy is strangely beautiful to watch, and so is Sarah's acceptance of him. This is a very peculiar portrait of love. In the end, it's also a very moving one.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.